Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is the second hour of the show. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a guy who was a part of the radio scene in Chicago for a long time. And in fact, I think if you listen to AM news radio in Chicago any time from about 1969 to the year 2000, chances are you heard this man's voice. His name's Bob Crawford, and he worked for WBBM Radio, the CBS affiliate there, covering City Hall and other news for a long time. He had the opportunity to talk with all of the mayors, including the first Mayor Daley, all of the governors of Illinois during that period, a couple of presidents, and some other guys as well, some people who were important in Illinois and in Chicago politics. He was hired there at BBM in 1969 to cover City Hall, and he retired in 2001. And now he has given, just recently, he has given a lot of material that he accumulated over his career to the University of Illinois. And indeed, now here at the U of I, we have the Crawford Audio Archives. There will be a symposium to celebrate that fact this afternoon, starting at 4:15 in room 100 of Gregory Hall. So people in and around Champaign-Urbana certainly could stop in there for the event. Bob went here to the University of Illinois here when he was a student. He actually worked for WILL. He also worked for WPGU and also WCIA Television, the CBS affiliate here in Champaign-Urbana. So it's nice to know that someone can indeed go on from WILL to achieve greatness. And there may be some hope for the rest of us. As we sit here and talk with Bob Crawford, you certainly can call in. If there are people who are listening that have questions, you can call 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, so even people listening in Chicago can call in. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here you want to join the conversation, you certainly may. Well, thanks for being here.
David, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Again, I'm one of those guys who grew up around Chicago and listened a little bit to News Radio 78 and remembered hearing you. What got you interested in radio in the first place?
Well, actually, I had an uncle who was working in radio back in Massachusetts. I'm a native of that state. And so I got bitten by the bug when I went to visit him one day and saw everything that went on in the studio and all of the control rooms and everything. And I thought to myself, gee, this looked like it would be an interesting profession to go into. And that's where it really all started. And then after that, it was a question of where would I want to go to get a journalism education. And at that time, as is true today also, the School of Communications at the University of Illinois was recognized as the top, one of the top institutions in the country. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I just happened to, when I got here, win a partial scholarship for baseball, which kind of helped pay the bills. And so, but it was mainly for the education that I came here. And I never regretted that, David, because what I learned here in the journalism school, I used every day in some way in my professional career. And that's why I donated my audio archives to the university library, because I said, you know, I always felt this need to give something back. And this is my small way of doing it.
Yeah. You were working at a radio station in Peoria, I guess that's the story that I got, when the folks at BBM heard you and thought, well, this would be a good guy for us to have working for us?
You know, so much is a matter of the luck of timing, as we know in this business, as it is in many other professions. And it was that way with me, because the Richard Speck trial, which was gaining a lot of publicity at the time, that was the man who slayed seven student nurses, a terrible, terrible story. There was a change of venue that moved the trial to Peoria. And I was working in Peoria at the time, and I got to cover the trial. And so CBS Radio called me and said, you know, we're very interested in this story. It's become a nationwide crime story. So we want you to do reports for us, and we want you to do reports for our owned and operated station, WBBM. And so I started to do that, and the rest was history. They liked my work, and they invited me up to Chicago one day, and I spent the next 33 and a half years with CBS.
Well, and that's a little unusual in the radio world. At least it's more common for people to move around, because that's the way the that you move up. You move up to bigger markets. You hope that you move up to bigger salaries. And for somebody to stay in one place, I should talk, having been here all this time, but for somebody to stay in one place like that for such a long time, that's pretty unusual.
It is, David, and I think the main reason for it was my area of expertise, which was politics and government. It is so important when you cover those areas to have an institutional memory, which is what I acquired after a period of time. The longer I worked at it, the more I knew, and consequently, the more valuable I became to CBS. And I think they finally decided that they didn't want to let me go, because if I did and they brought somebody else in, it would take, you know, 5 years of experience before they could be back to where they were. And so I've always felt grateful for the opportunity. CBS always treated me really great. And by the way, they never asked me what my politics were when I joined CBS. This nonsense that we are, you know, have a liberal bias, I think is really not true. I think people ought to know that. There are mistakes that are made, but no one ever asked me what my politics were. They never told me how to cover a story or how to write it. They always said, just do a fair and honest and objective job. That's all they ever said to me, and I tried my best to do that for 33 years.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's also true to say that at the time you retired, certainly among broadcast journalists in Chicago, and maybe among journalists in Chicago just generally, I think that there was very high regard for you among your colleagues. And a lot of it, I think, had to do with the fact that you had been covering Chicago politics for a very long time and had that deep background going back to the first Daley administration.
Right. And also, I think what helped me, too, was establishing early on, at the urging of my professors here at the university, a strong code of personal ethics, which always served me well through my career. You know, a lot of people view ethics as being just do the minimum that's required of you. I never looked at it that way. I always said that in addition to avoiding the obvious conflicts of interest, what you had to do was avoid even the appearance of impropriety, the same rule that judges follow. Because the trust that people place in journalists is so important that you can never do anything that even calls into question your honesty or your integrity or your impartiality. And I will never thank myself enough for establishing that strong code of ethics and, come heck or high water, standing by it all through my years. It served me well.
Yeah. Why do you think it is that today so many people seem to have such a low opininion of journalists, generally, of reporters?
Well, of course, it's become a favorite pastime almost to kill the messenger. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the media are the ones who let the people know when things are going wrong. And that kind of information isn't always greeted with enthusiasm by the listeners, who have their own point of view as to what they think is right or wrong. But I think what a lot of people might forget is that if we appear negative at times, it's because it is the job of the mainstream media to act as a watchdog on government and politicians, to let the people know when things are not going right, when they are not getting their money's worth for out of government, and more importantly, when the trust they placed in their political leaders is not being well served. You know, there are thousands of public relations firms out there and thousands more consultants who go to work for government agencies and government officials with one purpose, and that's to make their bosses look good. They won't tell you when something is wrong. It's the media that tells you when things are not going right. And I think if a lot of people out there don't like the way we do that, maybe what they ought to be asking is, why is it that we have so much to report about? Maybe we ought to be taking a look at the way our government serves us nowadays and maybe listen a little bit more to what we're reporting. Now, does that mean that we should never report about anything good? Certainly not. I've always felt that my watchdog function was to tell when things are going well as well, when somebody did a good job. For example, the Head Start program has drawn a lot of praise, and deservedly so. It worked very well as a government program. Welfare reform, which was very controversial when it first came in, no one knew how it was going to work. There have been stories done about how it's working pretty good in a number of states, despite some problems. And so I think the media need to focus, too, on what is good that's happening in government, but their primary responsibility, though, is to let the public know when things are not going right.
Yeah. Our guest this morning is a veteran Chicago radio journalist, Bob Crawford. He worked for more than 30 years for WBBM, an AM radio, all-news radio station in Chicago, starting in 1969 when they hired him to cover City Hall. He retired in 2001. He, in 1995, was inducted into the Chicago, what is it, the
Chicago Journalism Hall of Fame.
He's a graduate of the University of Illinois, has given his materials, things that he accumulated over his professional career, his audio archives to the university. And there'll be a symposium, the Crawford Symposium, in celebration of that this afternoon, beginning at 4:15 at 100 Gregory Hall on the U of I campus. And questions are certainly welcome here, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So were there points over the years in Chicago where someone tried to hire you away?
No, but there was a time when one of my former bosses talked to me about the possibility of moving to Washington to work covering Congress. And it came at kind of a bad time because I had an older son then who was a gifted athlete and a middle distance runner in track, and he had a close relationship with his high school coach. He was a senior then. Mm-hmm. And then when I came home and talked to my wife about the offer, I looked into the faces of my children. And when I saw them giving me that look of, please don't do this, Dad, I made the decision that my family was more important than the job. I had a lot of people at CBS say, Bob, we don't understand. People would give their right arm to work in Washington. Hmm. But I said, no, the family is more important. David, I always wanted my kids to know what the words hometown meant, because I believed in putting down roots and that roots are what make kids grow better. You know, they often say that a plant once uprooted never grows with quite the same vigor in its new location. I never wanted that to happen to my kids.
Yeah. And I suppose, too, if you cover politics, Chicago is a great place.
Well, it is. It really is. And, of course, Richard J. Daley made it such a good place because he was the last of the big city political bosses, the most powerful mayor in the country, who could call President John F. Kennedy or Lyndon Johnson and get them on the phone, not get a secretary on the phone. And I don't know there was any other mayor in the country who could do that. And so when you covered him, there was a sense that when anything happened of any substance, it was not only a good story, but that a little bit of history was being made, too. Yeah. And to be in on history is a rare thing.
Well, and then you think about the people, though, that also served in the mayor's office, Mike Blandick and Jane Byrne and Harold mm-hmm. Washington, and the current Mayor Daley, or are all in a way really outsized, very colorful figures. Jane Byrne, I'm not sure, so sure about Mike Blandick, but Jane Byrne certainly was, and Harold Washington certainly was. Mm-hmm. And the Mayor Daley the Younger seems very much a man in the mold of his dad.
He does. There are a lot of things he does, like yeah. his dad, like concentrating on the delivery of city services, for example, mm-hmm. a big project-oriented, which his dad was, those kind of things. In some ways, he's different, though. He's a lot more open with the news media than his father was. His father actually hated the media, and my philosophy always was that the reason for that is that we were the one institution he couldn't control. And to Richard Daley, as well as to his son, control is very important. But this Mayor Daley rules on the basis of a political coalition, which is a little bit less powerful than a machine. He rules on a coalition of conservative white ethnics who are the backbone of the old machine, a black middle class, which seems to like the work that he's been doing, and Hispanics. And as we all know, David, history tells us that coalitions can fall apart real easily. Mm-hmm. So he knows he needs the media. He wants positive play, and so he deals with us a lot more even-handedly than his dad did.
Yeah. We have a couple of callers here. Why don't we talk with them? First, someone listening in Champaign, line number one, right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
You know, it's interesting as far as why it is that people seem to have less trust or I don't know what, just don't have as good an opinion of journalists these days. And it seems to me that in the past, people, you know, the trust was built on, as you were talking about, the respect, the knowledge, expertise that people had. Nowadays, it seems that people are just so much more celebrity-focused. That is, the journalists themselves seem to be so much more in the limelight than they were in the past. Even some radio broadcasters have jumped ship and have gone over to being in, you know, on the talk shows, the Sunday morning talk shows, mm-hmm. and things of that sort. I thought, could you give some comment regarding that phenomenon and perhaps your opinion as to whether or not that has had some negative impact on the whole field of journalism?
Well, I think that your observation is quite correct. Let me say that to begin with. I have always been troubled mm-hmm. about celebrity journalism and celebrity journalists because it can create a lot of problems. Now, on the plus side, it must be said that, you know, broadcasting, for example, is a business. And newspapers are a business. If they can't make money, then they can't deliver the service to you that they're supposed to be delivering in the way that they should be delivering it. So you need people like Peter Jennings, God bless his soul, and Tom Brokaw, and even Dan Rather and others, to attract an audience to watch the news programs. If you don't get that, you can't charge the advertising dollars that you need to support the rest of your news effort. And believe me, it is very expensive to operate a news organization worldwide. But on the other hand, I agree with you that there are some troubling aspects to this. And one example of it is in the mistake that my own company made on the issue of President Bush's military service. We all know what happened there in the 60 Minutes 2 debacle, where there were mistakes made. It wasn't sure that the documentation they were using to show that the president hadn't been showing up for meetings and so forth was accurate. They were dealing with this guy who was a Bush hater, yet they didn't double and triple check him. It seemed to me at least not enough. But one of the problems there was that Dan Rather himself wasn't involved in covering the story. He was off doing other things because, as the celebrity leader of CBS, they wanted him to be very visible. He was off covering hurricanes somewhere, standing in front of damage, standing in the wind with a raincoat on like they always do. He gets back to New York. He relies on his producer to give him this information on what is supposed to be accurate. He goes and he voices the story. He raised some questions, but certainly not enough. It goes on the air with his voice, his name, his presence, and it turns out to be wrong, and he ends up with egg on his face and gets all the criticism. I have always been bothered by this business of the celebrities not being involved enough in the preparation of the stories. So it does have its downside. Ma'am, you're quite right. There is a lot of celebrity journalism now. It is driven, I think, by the money factor. A lot of the people who are in charge of the networks now are what I call bean counters. They are not people who came up as trained journalists. And so what they look at is the money side. They're business people. And sometimes they tend to forget the journalism side. And you know what's so sad about this? If they would only take a step back and realize it, it is the news organizations of the networks especially that made their networks so famous and trusted by a broad segment of the American people.
Oh, that is true.
When Bill Paley headed CBS, he was proud of his news organization. There wasn't any amount of money he wouldn't have spent to have us get a story. I remember that because I was there when he was still in charge of CBS. We just went and did whatever was necessary. And because people had the trust in us that we would give them honest, fair reporting, I always thought that carried over into the programming area.
No, well, I agree. I think I was brought up with the strong news in the evening, and that was what we really watched. And mm-hmm. then the programs themselves were secondary if you kept the TV on. Usually we turned it off. But, it was really you watched because the news was on.
Yeah. Let me try to add a caveat, if I may, though, and that is I don't think we should be overly critical of the system the way that it works now. You have a lot of bloggers out there who are not really interested in actual facts. I mean, they're giving you more opinion and hearsay, in my opinion, than they are in anything else. But that said, I think if you stop for a moment and consider the volume of facts, of information that the networks and the major newspapers are responsible for gathering every day, assimilating, writing, and putting into a form where the public can understand it, if you look at all of that volume that they report every single day, I think it is amazing how few mistakes there really are, as magnified as they get.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's true. But I still think it would be nice, I hate to be talking like, I'm pining for the old days, but to some extent, it was simpler. You trusted somebody to deliver the news, and you trusted mm-hmm. that person would give you the facts, and you you would read in the paper, and it would coincide. It would actually, it would validate
yes.
things.
Right.
And you, it's just so hard to keep up with everything that's both on the internet, on the paper, and in the and on TV, in the radio. And maybe it's just overload for me, and I'd like it to be a little more simple.
Your frustration is well taken, because I think what this is a reflection of is that there are so many different types of media out there now, many of them operating 24 hours a day. All of these infotainment networks pretending to be about information, but really about entertainment. The screaming and the yelling that goes on back and forth, the more the better it seems, because they can get attention and get an audience maybe. And we're almost in a situation now where we're like, every time the major leagues undergo an expansion, and every time the NBA or the NFL undergoes an expansion, I don't know if you're a sports fan or not, man, but my point is that every time the leagues undergo an expansion, the quality of play always goes down for a while. And it takes time to get a lot of better players in there to staff the new teams that come into the league. We're almost kind of in that situation now in journalism. It's my hope that eventually all of the boats will rise in the lake as everybody realizes we need to get better people to fill all of these additional positions out there.
Well, thanks so much for your comments.
You're welcome, ma'am. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to someone else, a caller here in Charleston on our line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, a couple of questions. Your tenure at WBBM was from the 1970s. My question is, I listened to that to WBBM religiously in the 1960s, and there was a gentleman on whose name was Jerry Williams. Do you remember him?
Yes, I do, sir. Jerry was still at the station when I first joined WBBM. He did an evening talk show, which was very popular.
Yes, he did.
And then when the format changed, there was really nothing left for Jerry to do, so he left. And after that, he moved his show to Boston and was very popular in the Boston market for a while. And after that, I'm sorry to say, I lost track of him.
Well, he moved somewhere up in upstate New York to a tiny...
I see.
And then I followed him to Boston, too. And that was one of the most informational and poignant radio programs. And I was driving light delivery then at night, and I could tune that in between stops. I kept up with it. But nevertheless, it was a great deal of information, and the Vietnam War was roaring. And I listened to Boston Station when Jerry would go off, and they had a wide program of people, and kept the dialogue going. And nowadays, that is all gone.
You know, one of the things I liked about Jerry that I thought distinguished him from some other talk show hosts is that he always came to the program prepared. Well prepared. He knew the subject matter just like a regular journalist would. And when he put people on the air, he pretty much knew what questions to ask. And so the people didn't get a free ride when they came on the air with Jerry Williams. They had to handle the tough along with the good, and that's what I thought made the show so interesting.
Yes, and the people that responded and all the subject matter, you know, all the civil rights and things like that were
right up
in the air then, on top of the war and other things. He had a good night now and then. He'd open the lines and no necessarily subject matter, you know, or subject of that evening.
Mm-hmm.
But it was one of the grandest programs I ever tuned into. And WBBM, you know, back then all we had were payphones along the road, and it was impossible for me to call in. But I learned a great deal from that.
Permit me to just put in a little plug, if I may. I don't normally do this, but when I was at BBM as a political editor, I used to do a program on Sunday mornings called At Issue. And I used to try to do the same sort of thing, and that is I would bring in guests and I would bring in a reporter from the Tribune and one from the Sun-Times, and we would grill, and I think that was the right word, we would grill guests on the air. There were some guests, I must tell you, who didn't want to come on, but they did because they needed the attention. It wasn't because we were unfair.
It was just
that they knew they were going to be asked the tough questions they would have preferred not to answer. So my point is that in a different way, we tried to continue doing the same thing because we were very aware of what the audience like with Jerry.
Sure. Well, and David Inge, in my opinion, is representative of that paradigm in these times, you know, which there's not enough of it, really. But my other comment is, or question, how do you perceive that the imperialization for the news media, both TV and radio and newspapers, have turned into conglomerates, and I think that squelches the popular opinion.
Yeah. Generally speaking, I'm troubled by that, but I'm not sure what can be done about it.
Yes.
You know, we are in the global age now, as they keep telling us. And the rule of thumb seems to be that if you're not big, you'll get squashed.
Yes, and that seems...
And it's a shame, because I think there is a media concentration going on out there, especially in radio, where you see a few conglomerates owning like as many as, you know, 400 or 500 radio stations. And a lot of the times, the syndicated programming on these networks all goes to the same stations. And so what you tend to get is an homogenized kind of programming, and I'm very worried about that. However, let me say real quickly, though, that I still think there are a lot of choices out there if you look for them. It's just that it's a little bit harder to find them.
Yes. I have a friend who has told me about a few stations around late night, all of them late night. You know, Rush Limbaugh, he gets the daytime. Mm-hmm. It seems the left, and they're relegated to nighttime airspace. And the last thing I'll say is that I live in Charleston here, a little college town, and we had a local newspaper, one in Charleston, one in Mattoon. And about 2 years ago, or maybe three, they were bought up by Lee Enterprises, stationed out in Dakota or someplace. You know, mm-hmm. Don't even know these places exist, but they take it. Well, I write letters to the editor, and it took me the longest time to get an I right from the left. And it took me the longest time to get that organized, and I finally had to go through Decatur and called out where their home office was, and then I finally got my letters began to be reproduced again. But I felt that, you know, just as a tiny little individual out here in the middle of nowhere, but if it's like that here, then what I observe in the international and even the international press, it's really stifling.
You know, I can tell you from experience that when you write letters, they do get read by somebody.
Yes.
And if there are a lot of letters on a given subject, then the stations really do pay attention. They would be foolish not to. They really do. So if all of you out there, if you have been tempted to write a letter but think, well, it wouldn't make a difference, they would just throw it in the trash can, oh, no, they don't.
Yes.
They do read them. And so please feel free to do that and express your opinions. I think the give and take between the audience and reporters is something we need more of. You know, one of the shameful things about radio is, David, that we don't get to see our listeners. Mm-hmm. We don't get to meet many of them, really. They just listen, and if they're satisfied with the program, well, they don't write at all. And I used to like to encourage people to write or to call me or to email me, because a lot of times you can't guess what's on their minds. I would be surprised a lot about what concerned people. I would think, although it must have been this issue, but no, it was this issue. You know, and so I think it's very important to do that. You mentioned Rush Limbaugh, and a lot of my colleagues wouldn't agree with me when I say this, but I think Rush serves a very important purpose as a conservative radio host. I don't always agree with him, but I think it's important to have all points of view getting an airing. I can remember a time when conservatism was out and was so mocked that conservative politicians couldn't get a voice anywhere. This was back in the Barry Goldwater days. Now people like Rush have given a voice to conservatism. I think that's good, not bad. I would only invite listeners to listen to all points of view.
And thank you very much.
Right, thanks for the call. A little bit past the midpoint here. Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Bob Crawford. For more than 30 years, he worked in radio in Chicago. He worked for the CBS station there, WBBM, a news station, covering City Hall and generally covering Chicago and Illinois politics. He has a degree here from the University of Illinois. He has a journalism degree, graduated in 1959. He did work here on this radio station, WYLO, also WPGU, and also did some work for the local CBS television affiliate here in Champaign-Urbana, WCIA. He was working at a station in Peoria covering the trial of Richard Speck when the folks at CBS noticed him and said, we'd like you to work for us. And he was recruited there to cover City Hall and Chicago politics at BBM and was there through 2001 when he retired. He's won many awards for his work. In 1995, he was inducted into the Chicago Journalism Hall of Fame. And he has given his audio archives to the University of Illinois. It's the Crawford Audio Archives. And there's a symposium going on here, in fact, today on the campus beginning at 4:15 in 100 Gregory Hall to talk about that and to acknowledge that. And if people are interested, I'm sure that they could stop by. Questions here or two are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. We do have someone else here also in Charleston to talk with. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
About Dan Rather and the letters about Bush's military record. It seems to me he let himself get knocked off the bar on two counts. His second broadcast, the one where he actually interviewed the secretary, should have been the first one. And he let the authorship of the letters become the story rather than the content of the letters, which was never in dispute. So on both counts, he got himself knocked off the bar, and the real story never really got out.
I think those points are both well taken, and I would agree with you. And I think that a lot of mistakes were made, some of which involved what it is that you're talking about here. And I just have a feeling that those mistakes might not have been made had Dan been more involved in the actual story itself from day one. One of the things that's always troubled me a lot about this story is that they were dealing here with a guy who was what we call a Bush basher. He had leveled a lot of criticism at the president on blog sites and so forth. And when there's a rule of journalism that says that whenever you get somebody like that giving you information, it's a red flag. What you have to do is you have to get at least two other credible sources to corroborate what he's telling you. Well, it seems to me that they didn't do that. You're right that the document was never proven one way or the other to be right or wrong, but there was just too much of a rush to get the story on the air, too. And I don't think really it was because of a liberal bias. I think it was just Mary Mapes, who was the executive producer on the show, doing the story, saying, boy, this is a great story. And you know what? The funny thing about it is one of the great ironies is that when all is said and done, that story didn't say much more than what had already been out there in the media and which had been aired during Bush's first presidential campaign. So I found it kind of odd, except for the manner in which the story was being reported, which in my judgment was kind of sloppy. And I just simply thought it could have been done better. But I don't think there was a bias against the president there. They were looking at it as a great story.
Yeah. Like I say, I think the second story should have run first, where mm-hmm. he sat down with the secretary and said, did you type these letters? She said no.
Yeah.
But is the content valid? And she said yes.
Yes, right.
That would have given the story more leg.
Let me say one other thing, too, though. I thought one thing that was strange as the story went on, you were talking about the content of the letter not being focused on, and you're quite right. I found that as the debate raged on and the conservative radio talk hosts were bashing Dan Rather, which they love to do, that after a while, Dan himself became the focus, not the story. And I found that rather curious. I mean, because it seemed to me that at some point we should have taken a step back and say, you know what, Dan's not the story here. The point is the content, and did it stand up? And we kind of lost our way a little bit in that debate, it seemed to me.
Well, I really appreciate your pointing out that journalism should be presenting the facts as much as possible with as little bias as possible, knowing, of course, that there always will be some bias, but mm-hmm. trying to be as impartial as possible to make the public as informed as possible.
And so you know what, sir? There are so many other journalists I know of. I could give you a long, long list who believe the way that I do and who have worked the way that I did. I'm not alone in this. I like to believe that most journalists think about the need for strong ethics, think about fairness and balance and objectivity every day that they work. I think they take their responsibility seriously. The serious journalists I know don't just treat journalism as a profession. To them, it's a calling.
Yeah. What do you think it is or was about Dan Rather that made him such a story personally? It seemed that that didn't happen with Peter Jennings or Tom Brokaw. You didn't hear stories. Now, maybe it did indeed have to do with things that Dan did.
Yeah.
But you didn't hear a lot of stories about those other guys and what they did when the cameras were off. And they didn't seem to say things that got them into trouble. Now, maybe this did have something to do with Dan himself. But he just seemed to be a magnet for bad news that put him in a bad light.
Well, Dan has always been kind of a little bit of a lightning rod. It may have something to do with his personality. I don't know. A lot of people thought that he was brash and kind of looked arrogant and believed mm-hmm. he was always right. I knew Dan for a long time, and he wasn't really that way, even though he may have created that impression. He was as serious about the job as everybody else. But I have a feeling that it's a good question, David, because I've thought about this a lot, and I have a feeling it goes back to when he had some differences with the first President Bush, President Bush's dad, where he had engaged in some very tough interrogation, and a lot of people came off thinking that he was disrespectful to the president. I don't think Dan meant to be that way. I think he meant to show the public, I'm not afraid to ask the tough questions. Mm-hmm. But it kind of came off that way. And he and the president had a famous exchange where he fired at the president and the president fired back at him. A lot of people thought Dan was being unfair. Now here's President Bush's son in the presidency. They're doing this story on him, on his military service. And I think a lot of the conservative commentators and conservative writers who probably had their doubts about Dan all along, made that connection. Some of them actually did. Rush Limbaugh made the connection on the air. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the link that got them thinking, well, he was unfair to his father. He's probably being unfair to his son, too.
Yeah. Well, and I think about also going even back before that famous altercation between him and Richard Nixon.
Yes, right.
There was a press conference, and he asked a pointed question. And Nixon mm-hmm. says to him, are you running for something? And other reporters there sort of laughed. And then Rather says, no, Mr. President, are you?
Yes.
And a lot of people thought that was over, that he had stepped over the line there.
You know, the rule of thumb is when you're a reporter, you have to stay under control when you're doing an interview or when you're in a news conference. No matter what else you may think of a president or a governor or even a mayor, somebody like Mayor Daley in Chicago, even if you don't respect them, you must respect the office. Mm-hmm. And if I were Dan, I wouldn't have responded. I would have just laughed along with the other reporters and let it go. But if you fire back, then it seems to me you are crossing that line of objectivity and you're getting a little bit into the area of being subjective. And I think people have a right to criticize that because they expect us to be disciplined enough as journalists to avoid that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will talk now with someone in Chicago. Line number 4. Right here. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to ask a question or comment on the media coverage of political corruption in Chicago. For many years, the media seemed to give Mayor Daley a pass, even though the average person in Chicago knows the score as far as, hiring and, the situation as far as elections here. But yet, for many years, the media just touted Daley as a great mayor, one of the best mayors and a great administrator. And it just seems to me that they gave him a pass out of liberal bias, because without the Daley machine, Illinois really isn't a blue state anymore. It's really a red state, but the political machine here delivers the vote. And I think they were willing to look the other way for many years and, touted him as a great mayor when the average person on the street knew the score, knew what's going on in Chicago, and it's still going on as far as, fairness of elections here. And I'd just like to know your thoughts about that.
First of all, are you talking about the current Mayor Daley?
Yes.
Okay. Well, now we're talking about a mayor who's been in office for 16 years, and there have been scandals on and off. I was there for a lot of them, and I must honestly tell you that most of those scandals became public knowledge through the news media that you're talking about. So I don't think they gave the mayor a pass at all. But sometimes, because of the ebb and flow of information and the way it comes out, oftentimes federal prosecutors with their enormous resources, including the IRS, where they can examine tax returns and so forth, will get to wrongdoing before we can get there. And then we're just left to report what they find out. The current scandal, for example, which has over 30 people indicted and convicted, the hired truck scandal, for example, and the political hiring, that came out through the news media. And so I think I would have to disagree with you. I think the news media has always been aggressive about reporting whatever they can find out. But is it fair to say they're not always the first? No, they would love to be the first to do it. But they're not always first because the federal authorities have those enormous resources that they can bring into play. And, you mentioned about how the people know better. I have to honestly tell you that one of the things that bothers me about Chicago is that I think a lot of voters, and I wouldn't necessarily include you, sir, but I think a lot of voters I came in contact with over the years were very cynical about public corruption in Chicago because there's been so much of it, and it's become so ingrained in the everyday part of doing government, the pay-to-play system has been in place for so long, that people tend to be cynical and think, well, you know, no matter who the mayor is, we're always going to have corruption. So let's set that issue aside, and let's look at the mayor in terms of what else he's done. How well does he deliver the basic services? Does he keep the city livable? Do the police and fire departments operate well? Do the trains and buses run on time? Does he get big projects done like Millennium Park and the museum campus and Navy Pier and so forth? And if you put aside corruption and just analyze Mayor Daley on that front, then he tends to get much better marks from the voters than he ordinarily would get. And I think that's the reason why he's still sitting at a job approval rating around 52%. Despite all the corruption. If this were any other city but Chicago, the mayor would be in deep political trouble. But he's not here, and I have to believe it's because of that deeply ingrained cynicism where voters think no government here is ever going to be completely honest, so let's judge him on something else. It's a shame, really, but people have a short memory for corruption. Watch what happens in Congress. You know, if there's been a lot of talk that the Republicans could lose control of the U.S. House because of the corruption scandal in Washington, I think not. I think they'll have a short memory for that. Not a lot of politicians are involved in it. People are not going to hold their congressman responsible for something another congressman did. If the Republicans lose control of the House in the fall, it will be because of other issues like not delivering on Social Security reform, which the president had made a priority. It will be not delivering on health care reform. It will be by approving a drug prescription program, which fell well short of what both parties had promised, and which is so confusing, seniors can hardly understand it. Those are the issues that will matter. And in Chicago, most voters tend to just want the city to be livable. And well, if it's livable, they tend not to care as much about the corruption as they ought to.
Well, I don't dispute the fact that stories have been reported on in the past, but this image of him as a good administrator, mm-hmm. I think, has been perpetuated by the media. And I think that's why the people have this attitude, because there have been politicians in the past, and the image was not the same. And I just don't think that, I don't think it's, there's unanimity to the fact that Daley is a good administrator. You know, he's done maybe some good things. I don't dispute that. But, to get that reputation, I think a lot of that comes out of the media. And I think that's because it was convenient for them, because he delivered the vote candidates.
Well, you know, sir, you're right that you hear a lot about the positive things the mayor has done, but that's his public relations machinery that's doing that. They're the ones who put the twist on the truth and who only talk about the positives. But I think the media have been pretty fair and balanced in talking about the good and the bad, which is what you have to do with any government leader. You have to do it with a governor or with a president. President Bush hasn't been wrong about everything, even if you disagree about him going into Iraq. Not everything he's done has been wrong. So I think that reporters, when they look at a public official like Mayor Daley, they look at the good and the bad, and they don't try to tell you whether to believe more about the good or the bad. They just leave it to you to make the judgment.
Well, I don't believe that, but I respect your opinion.
All right. Well, okay. Thanks for the call. Let's go talk with somebody else here. And I think that we have a caller on line number 2 in Paris. And that would be right here. Hello.
That's me, but I'm from Chicago.
Oh, you're from Chicago. Oh, yes. You, sir. Yes, sir. I know your voice. You're from Chicago. Yes,
after
go ahead.
These years,
yes.
What I want to say is that the guy who was just on ahead of me thinks that Daley is a liberal. Well, he's far from being a liberal. He's tied in with the real estate interests and all that who give him primary backing. But what I'd like to ask of you is, to describe a little bit, if you will, the battles or the by Leon Dupre and the people that he led, the reformers in Chicago against the old Daley, and the fact that that group no longer exists, essentially. They've been eliminated, I guess.
Yes, you're right, sir. That's a very good point to make. First of all, let me say you're quite right about where Mayor Daley sits on the political spectrum. I would view him as more of a moderate than a liberal as well. And his dad was very much like that, too. I think that kind of being in the middle in the political center has served him well. And as a matter of fact, I think it serves most politicians well when they kind of are in the political center or at least close to it. I think they all try to be as much as they can eventually when they're governing, if not when they are running for the office. But Let me go on to talk a little bit about the Richard J. Daley years. You're quite right. This gentleman mentioned Leon Dupre. He was one of the leaders of a very vocal minority that was in the city council at that time. There were about six or seven of them, I think, right, sir?
Right.
And they were very active in criticizing the Richard J. Daley administration at that time, were criticizing the wasteful, inefficient, and patronage and the corruption that was going on in the administration, and it was rampant, the vote stealing that was going on Election Day. They fought Mayor Daley tooth and nail, but of course they didn't have the power to get anything through the city council, so it really turned out to be just rhetoric. But they were a group of very sharp people who knew how to read the city budget, who knew where the flaws were, and could really get the attention of the media, even though, as it turned out, Daley's power was such that it didn't make much difference on Election Day. Nowadays, you've got a situation where that vocal minority is not there anymore. The council is pretty much more of a rubber stamp than it was under Richard J. Daley. I think historically one of the big reasons for that, sir, is the fact that now that there is no more machine as such, then more and more members of the city council are beholden to Mayor Daley for getting reelected to city council. All of the resources are with him. All of the money to help the alderman put out those fancy brochures before the election that tout the aldermanic service. They're the ones who buy them he's the one who buys them the advertising on radio and TV if they need to do that, if their races are close. He is the one who delivers all of the service to them in their wards. He is the guy who sees to it that the city budget contains the kind of perks that go into the individual wards that the aldermen can brag about, and then they stand there with Mayor Daley at a ribbon-cutting ceremony in the ward, and they put that into their local newspapers. They are more beholden to him now than they were in the old machine days, and because of that, my theory is that there's less chance of those aldermen being critical of the mayor now than they were in the old days, whether it made a difference or not. However, I think there are some interesting changes beginning to take place in the city council now. I see some aldermen, not like Ricky Munoz, for example, not afraid to stand up and criticize the mayor for on this political hiring and for this hired truck scandal. Where is it going to go? I don't know, but I'm encouraged by the fact that there's about two or three aldermen there now who are not afraid to speak out. And in some recent skirmishes in the council, the Mayor Daley had to back off because he would have lost the vote.
Can I add something?
Yeah, sure.
To what you've just said, Mark? Part of the extension of the corruption, I believe, is that a lot of governmental jobs are being eliminated and jobs are being sold to private interests. And essentially, and I think this is another source of corruption. And who's getting paid off? I don't know, but this is at least the way I see it. This is what the situation, and I don't know how far we go. The so-called downgrading of government, he's all part of it, and it's all basically essentially running along with the Republicans nationally and statewide, and well, let's put it that.
Yeah, well, you raised a couple of points there, and one is the overall corruption in the city. I think one of the reasons why it has festered under this Mayor Daley is because he has been in denial about the extent of that corruption. It is really deeply ingrained in city government. It has become institutionalized to the point where it's a part of the everyday business of doing government. And pretty soon the lines between right and wrong get blurred because people think the pay-to-play system is the way government is supposed to work. And I think so long as you have a mayor who is in denial on the extent of corruption, all he is ever going to do is tinker at the edges of reform. Now, I must say, though, he is doing more now under federal pressure than he did before. But the reason he was slow to respond is because of his view of corruption. It wasn't a few bad apples in the barrel. It's been far more extensive than that. Secondly, on the political hiring, you always hear people say, well, political hiring is kind of necessary in government, isn't it? It's the oil that keeps the gears working. Well, that's nonsense. I'll give you a few reasons why political patronage is wrong. First of all, it's unfair on its face. You're hiring people on the basis of favoritism, not on the basis of whether or not they're qualified. But one of the big problems is that when you have people who are hired on a political basis, they end up owing their loyalty to the people who put them in the job, not to the people they serve. And so you end up getting weaker, less efficient government by the very definition of what that system is all about, not to mention that it's a violation of a federal court consent decree.
Yeah. Real quick, and we want to try to get that Paris caller here, line number one. Hello? Is caller there in Paris? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. Hey, yeah. I was calling. I grew up in northern Michigan, and I had the luxury of Chicago Television and CBC Television, and I love Chicago Television and the news reporters like Faggy Flynn, Joel Daly, Bill Curtis. They drew you into the city. You know, you wanted to take the four-hour drive to go see Chicago and hear for yourself. And I don't see that right now in newscasters, both on the radio and television. You know, they're drawing you into the story, and you're like, hey, you know, this is fascinating stuff for you. The other thing about Mayor Daley is what I perceive, he doesn't like the Cubs. Is that true or not?
He doesn't like the Cubs. Well, he's a Southsider.
Yeah,
you know, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, please don't ask us to be boosters for the city of Chicago. We're not part of the public relations arm of government. But it does come out in the reporting, the strong points that Chicago has. The economy, its high bond rating, so on and so forth, its beautiful skyline. All those things have been reported on as a part of the overall mix. And so I think reporters have a certain respect for what Chicago has become over the years, when a lot of other cities for a long time were in decline. I often mention the contributions of Richard J. Daley, which I think were quite remarkable. In the days when the cities were in decline, Richard J. Daley was responsible during his tenure for carrying out $44 billion worth of new construction in the city of Chicago. It went on at a rate of $400 million a year for his 20 years in government. They used to say that Chicago was the city where the sound of the pile driver never ceased. Well, that came pretty darn close to being true. So there are a lot of good things to say about the city of Chicago, and I think there's a certain fondness that people still have for it. I don't think reporters have lost that, but they have to be very careful because it's their job to be fair and objective. And, you know, there's an old saying that Chicago has a clean face but a dirty neck, and reporters have to report both.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to leave it there with our thanks to our guest, Bob Crawford. For more than 30 years, he worked for the CBS radio affiliate there in Chicago, WBBM Radio, covering City Hall and Chicago, Illinois politics. He was there up through 2001 when he retired. He's won many awards. In 1995, was inducted into the Chicago Journalism Hall of Fame. He's a graduate of the University of Illinois and gave his archives, audio archives, to the university, the Crawford Audio Archives, now here at the U of I. There's a symposium going on to mark that fact this afternoon in room 100, Gregory Hall, starting at 4:15. So if people are interested, they can stop by. And for just as a way of closing, we'll say, go Sox, go Cubs.
I won't argue with that.
We're not going to play favorites here. Thank
David,
you.
David, thank you for having me, and you do an excellent. I agree with that one listener who said you do an excellent job on this program, and it's a pleasure to be here, and I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Much too kind. Well, I think it would be great if you could come back, and we'll go to the archives. We'll pull some stuff.
Sure.
And we'll play some things so
love
people can hear some of those voices.